You are tuned in to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain, BC.
Quick note that the following episode of Canada Land may contain subject matter and language that some people will find offensive.
This is as much my country as yours.
Killed my brother. You killed him, and you'll pay. You and all the other Turks.
I never killed your brother. It was an accident. I swear to God, Costa, if you don't stop this, I will shoot you. I will shoot you.
Enough. Stop it. This is not your problem, Canadian soldier. Not your war. This is Cyprus. Our problem.
I'm here as a member of the United Nations Peace Force. Now, both of you, go home. Nobody's going to shoot anybody.
The UN Peace Force was designed by a Canadian, Lester Pearson. In 1957, for his dream that soldiers could make peace instead of war, he received the Nobel Prize.
Peacekeeping. It's a part of our heritage. But is it? I'm not even sure people get those references anymore. You know, reference one being the heritage moments. Those cheesy government-funded dramatizations that started running on TV in the 90s, depicting patriotic episodes from our history. You just heard one of them. And does anyone get reference number two? Peacekeeping. Canadian troops in blue helmets. It used to be a useful standard to compare against reality. We fancy ourselves peacekeepers, but are Canada's peacekeeping missions truly neutral? We call ourselves peacekeepers, but what about our troops' involvement in that torture scandal in Somalia or those sexual assault accusations from Haiti? We call ourselves peacekeepers, but do we? Do we call ourselves peacekeepers anymore? Are we even trying to earn that proud designation? I mean, even amid all of the outrage towards our government over its relationship with Israel, are any protesters calling on Trudeau to send peacekeeping troops over there to intervene? There's really just one statistic worth sharing here to illustrate this. In the mid-1990s, there were over 3,000 Canadian troops deployed as peacekeepers around the world. Today, there are 60. What the hell happened? Got an answer for you today from Walter Dorn, professor of defense studies at the Royal Military College of Canada and the Canadian Forces College. Professor Dorn is an expert in arms control, international criminal law, just war theory, peace operations, and the United Nations. And he is going to join our senior producer, Bruce Thorson, in a moment. Wait for it.
Colonel Karen Van Doren, the Chief Military Observer or CMO of the UNMIN mission. You are the incoming military observers, here to serve the cause of the United Nations in Maryland.
Here's my avatar selection, and I'll pick a black female here. And now going in convoy, and we stopped at a checkpoint here. So with my mouse, I'll just do a look around.
Walter Dorn is playing a video game. The scene on his computer screen is a desert wasteland. Smoke rises in the distance, there's a couple of dead cows off to the side, and a bridge that his avatar needs to cross. But it's blocked by a group of armed men.
Hello. We've been expecting you blue helmets.
Walter Dorn helped design this game. The UN hopes to use it for training purposes.
Your role is to be able to find ways to stop people from being slaughtered, to be able to stop mass atrocity. Someone's pointing a weapon at you, and the armed escort has to make a decision about whether to fire at these threats. So there is still an element of the use of force, but it's much more constrained, like real peacekeeping. And it's done like a murder mystery, so that you have to uncover who's behind it.
Interesting.
The KLM attackers used Kalashnikovs with 7.62mm rounds. Where did the 5.56mm rounds come from?
And like the real conflict dynamics, there's usually multiple motivations and multiple players that are, all have different agendas, and that it's not just a simple case of a side A attacks side B.
This game has got to be one of the few video games in the world where the goal is not to shoot as many things as possible, but to stop the shooting, to be the peacemaker. I'm just going to quote from your online CV to give everybody a larger sense of what you do. It says, Walter Dorn is a professor of defense studies at the Royal Military College of Canada and the Canadian Forces College. He teaches officers of rank from major to brigadier general from Canada and about 20 other countries. He specializes in arms control, international criminal law, just war theory, peace operations, treaty verification and enforcement, as well as the United Nations. That is an illustrious CV. We're here in April 2024. It's the 30th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide, which is another moment in Canadian peacekeeping. But the mid-90s were really the high point of Canadian peacekeeping. At that point, there were over 3,000 Canadians deployed in peacekeeping missions around the world. Today, there are about 60, which works out to 2% of what our commitment was in the mid-90s. There's not many ways to phrase that other than a complete and absolute collapse of our commitment to pursuing, you know, international peacekeeping duties. So the question is, what has happened?
The answer to that question is very complex because it's a systemic problem. But I would say that at the basis of it is a reluctance of the Canadian military to deploy in peacekeeping operations. They find so many excuses why they can't do it. They're far more risk averse than they were in the 1990s. Canada was the number one in terms of fatalities in peacekeeping until around 2002. And that was because there was such a commitment to putting our men and women in uniform in harm's way in order to help maintain the world's peace. We had 115 fatalities. So the mission was very important for the Canadian government. And then in the 1990s, there were some negative experiences in Somalia.
Just before we go down that road, I want to give people a little bit more context. We took part in around 50 peacekeeping missions that involved around 125,000 Canadians since Lester Pearson's help in setting up the force in the mid-50s. That's a considerable commitment over time, and it makes it all the more shocking that we're sitting at the number of 60. I'm sorry to interrupt your flow there, but I thought it was necessary to have that background as we move towards your next point, which was on Somalia.
We had such a prestigious past in peacekeeping. We were the number one peacekeeper during the Cold War, contributing about 10% of UN forces. It was really a major contribution. And so the question is, why have we dropped? Why are we at such a dismal percentage of what we were before? And as I was explaining, the Somalia affair, where Canadian soldiers tortured Somali teenagers, that caused a really bad taste, and it wasn't actually part of a UN operation. It was part of a US-led operation in Somalia, but it's all being conflated together.
And can you provide us just a few more details on that? It's been a little while, and some of our listeners might not be fully aware of what happened.
The United States deployed a mission called UNITAF to secure the aid lines, the convoys, to provide aid to famine in Somalia. And then the UN was picked up on a mission called UNISOM, and Canada was transitioning its forces from being part of UNITAF to being part of UNISOM. And in that transition, soldiers actually tortured a Somali youth named Shadane Aron.
These are some of the guys from the Canadian Airborne Regiment, which captured a 16-year-old Somali named Shadane Aron, and then gave him a command performance with fists, boots, lit cigarettes, and iron bars.
So the Somali inquiry dug into this, and, And it received a lot of opposition from the leadership of the Canadian Armed Forces. And so it kept creating new headlines in newspapers for years as the Somalia Inquiry was trying to get to the bottom of all this, and it discovered racism and other factors in the Canadian Airborne Regiment. So it really gave the Canadian military a black eye, and it was tough to be working in the Canadian Armed Forces with all that bad news coming from the media. So many of the people who were there at the time talk about that as a really dark period for the Canadian Armed Forces. It was a very tough time. Add to that Rwanda, where some 800,000 people were killed while a peacekeeping mission was deployed.
Again, it might be useful at this point because it has been 30 years and that anniversary may be foremost in the minds of some people. If you could briefly restate what happened with Roméo Dallaire and Canada's involvement in Rwanda 30 years ago.
Sure. So the Rwandan mission was established in 1993 in order to oversee the Arusha Accords. And that was going to find a settlement so that the Tutsis and the Hutus could live peacefully inside Rwanda, because there had been ethnic strife and an attack by a Tutsi group against Rwanda in 1990 and a kind of civil war. So the Arusha Accords were a means to bring an end to that. And in April of 1994, on April 6th, the president's plane was shot down, most likely by Rwandan Hutus, in fact, possibly the presidential guard, that was really against the accords. So the genocide broke out, and it was very well planned. And the leader of the peacekeeping mission was a Canadian general, Roméo Dallaire. And he immediately went to the headquarters of the Ministry of Defense, and he saw that there were Rwandan commanders from all over the country all gathered there. And as soon as he entered the room, everything became quiet. And it later on became apparent to him that this had all been pre-planned, that the Bagasora, who was in the Ministry of Defense, had set up what he called the apocalypse. He had made a plan for killing the Tutsis in Rwanda, finding a sort of final solution for what he saw as the Tutsi problem. And Dallaire tried desperately to save Tutsis. He set up some safe areas in the Hotel Mille Collines, as well as the King Faisal Hospital and the Moro Stadium in Kigali. And those peacekeepers actually managed to save some 20 to 30,000 lives because of their presence there, and they wouldn't allow the Hutu militias to come in with their machetes and slaughter the people inside. But at the same time, the Security Council mandated that his mission should be cut.
And the whole NGO community, the whole international community, packed up and left. The only ones that were left there was finally my small force that was reduced to about 450, and the International Red Cross. Everybody else had gone.
And so he lost a lot of his capacity at a time when it was most needed to surge. And eventually the Security Council asked for a new mission, but the UN couldn't find the forces willing to go in. Canada was the only country that reinforced the mission in Rwanda. It sent in extra units during the genocide, and they did heroic work during the genocide.
Welcome to Team Site 2, Lieutenant Colonel Kenai. Good idea. Jock covers day-to-day operations and has the security updates.
This game, or simulation as we prefer to call it, is a form of edutainment. So it's got both the educational component, and can be used for UN peacekeeping training, and the entertainment value, so that it's fun to play at the same time as you can learn a lot. So you place yourself into the shoes of a peacekeeper.
If the problem is with armed bandits, we've got to investigate ASAP. See if there are violations of the ceasefire or of human rights.
Whether you take a bulldozer and just crush the weapons, or whether you take an acetylene welding torch and cut the weapons in half. There's lots of interesting features in peacekeeping that the world should know about. What they do when they're on patrol. How do they prevent genocide?
So these events in the mid-90s in Somalia and Rwanda, you're citing as key points in a change in attitude among the Canadian military about how to deal with UN peacekeeping. But I would say that is the military not subject to the instructions of their political masters? We do have a change of government there. Harper comes in a little bit later. The numbers do not improve. And when Trudeau came in, he actually campaigned on re-engaging with peacekeeping and the UN and putting Canada back in the world. But there has been no change. So I don't think...
Actually, Trudeau's contribution to peacekeeping, that is the contribution of the Canadian government to peacekeeping, is about half of what Harper had provided, even though he campaigned in three elections on re-engaging in peacekeeping.
Times have changed. Now, all too often, there is no peace to keep. The conflicts we face today are intractable, more dangerous, and more complex. Modern peace operations take place in a context that transcends borders and includes a challenging range of actors.
That was Justin Trudeau back on Wednesday announcing his plan for Canada's peacekeeping commitment much later and a little lighter than Liberals' first promise.
I mean, there's two subjects here. You mentioned that the military has become risk-averse, and the question is why. You've given us instances of Rwanda and Somalia. How do we unpack what's happened both with the military and their political masters in that time period?
There's not enough political will to overcome the inertia, the excuses or the lack of willingness to take risks that the military puts up in its arguments. So they'll say, well, we don't have adequate medical support for our forces if we go into the field. And they'll look at specific operations, say, this is far too risky. It's unlikely to achieve its goals. The obstacles are too great in the field. For instance, in Haiti, where there are gangs that would actually fire back against peacekeepers, prospective peacekeepers, the political leaders would have to put a lot of pressure to be able to get these things off the ground and insist. Because, of course, the military will follow whatever they're ordered to do. But at the same time, when they're giving advice, like Jonathan Vance would give to Trudeau, he would come up with all kinds of reasons why it was difficult to be able to do these kind of operations.
I do find it interesting, though, that you say there is some political will, but there is pushback from the forces themselves, because I don't think most people would think that that's the way the chain of command works. But you are someone who is on the inside, to a certain extent, of the military culture.
Yeah, I've seen it in objective, quantitative ways that the amount of training that the military does for peacekeeping is so little. It's, a quarter of what it was at the turn of the century. I see it in the attitudes and the expressions of many leaders. I've even spoken to the leader of the Canadian Armed Forces about the need to deploy more Canadian peacekeepers. The response was that there was no way that the forces were going to be put in situations where they didn't have adequate medical support and other types of support. I've also seen from many people the conversations that go on between Global Affairs Canada and DND. I should say that a lot of Canadian soldiers want to deploy in peacekeeping. Some of them joined for that. I've had people who were practically crying in my office saying that I've tried for years to get into a peacekeeping operation.
We've talked a lot about the number of Canadian soldiers, both historically, 125,000 have served in peacekeeping missions in the last 70 years or so. And we've talked about the massive decline from the height in a single moment of the mid-90s. But if I look at the numbers of who's actually contributing internationally to peacekeeping, these numbers are from 2021. Number one is Bangladesh, over 6,000. Nepal, number two, over 5,000. India, number three, at 5,000. Rwanda, over 5,000. These are the people who are providing soldiers to the UN forces. It's interesting to me that these developing nations are now the backbone of UN peacekeeping. There's not a Western democracy in that top five list. Is Canada symptomatic of a larger problem here, or has this always been the case?
Oh, that's a good point, because it is a larger systemic problem in the world. During the 1990s, the developing world and the developed world, the global north and the global south, contributed about equal numbers of peacekeepers, 50% each. But now it's about 80% from the developing world. The global south is making a much larger contribution, and the global north is restricting itself to very few missions where they have a substantial presence. So I would say that Canada was also following the general trend. During the Cold War, it was a leader. It actually could show how a middle power like Canada could play a major role, and it was standing out among nations. But afterwards, it was very typical of the Western countries to cease their major contributions to UN peacekeeping. And so this is very much a larger problem, but at the same time, it's no excuse for Canada not to show leadership that it once did.
At the same time, we have been involved in international conflict. We've been in Afghanistan. We've been involved in other commitments outside of the UN peacekeeping proper. Is this the way of the future? And what does this represent if that's actually the way we're going to operate?
Well, we're celebrating the 75th anniversary of NATO, and there's no doubt that NATO has an important role in the stability of the world today. NATO was created to support the United Nations. That was the original idea when Truman was leading it and when Canada was also promoting the establishment of NATO. And so I don't think the two should be seen as opposing each other.
I wouldn't say that, but I think what's striking here is that the peacekeeping missions were there to maintain a peace or enforce a peace, but not necessarily to fight. Afghanistan was about battle and fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Is that where we are now?
NATO also did peacekeeping operations. They actually successfully brought about peace in Bosnia after the UN gained many lessons that could be transferred to NATO. So it's not that NATO is incapable of doing peacekeeping. It is actually doing peacekeeping in Kosovo today. What I would say is that the number of peacekeepers, the number of missions is declining now, and the number of conflicts is increasing. And so the need is greater, but unfortunately the political will in the international community isn't there to establish the missions that are needed in places like Sudan, Haiti, or many other areas of the world. Yemen, there's a small peacekeeping mission, but it needs to be much expanded. And eventually in Ukraine, there will need to be a peacekeeping force, in my view. So there's a huge need there. But right now, the world has gone into these spasms of conflict, including especially in Gaza now, where the prospects of peacekeeping look very dim.
Gaza, Ukraine, these need to be mentioned. They need to be talked about. If we were burying our heads in the sand with these other conflicts over the last 30 years where we've been declining, whether you lay it at the feet of the military being risk-averse or the politicians not fulfilling their promises or the public just being generally disengaged from something that happens in Mali or somewhere else, the fact is in the last 7-8 months, Israel, more than Ukraine, has shown that people in Canada are not willing to bury their heads in the sand. There seems to be frustration all around that we can protest, we can voice our concerns, but we have no dog in the fight, either as a peacekeeper or as someone who can intervene in what's going on there. So yes, the conflicts are coming up and they beg the question of what can we do? And the frustration is on the streets of Canada, but there's no effective response that can be mustered as Canadians.
This is a much broader question about how to respond to the conflicts in the world today. And I would posit that peacekeeping is one of the primary tools that can be used to help bring about a resolution of those conflicts. There were peacekeepers under Pearson's force from 1956 to 1967 in Gaza. They were actually helping secure the borders of Gaza, and there were Canadians deployed on the borders with Gaza and Egypt. That could be part of the solution in the future. I see that peacekeeping is an extremely important role, and I think we should be advocating for more peacekeeping forces, for getting greater Canadian contribution. And with that greater contribution, we can also have more clout. We had 9 leaders of peacekeeping missions in the 1990s. We've had none since. So as an example of that, when you don't provide a large number of troops, then you can't get the leadership positions and be able to actually help at that senior level to save lives. We've lost a lot of the expertise that we had, how to work in the UN system, given that the UN is composed of 193 member states. This is a huge challenge, and our military was one of the best in the world to be able to work around those challenges during the Cold War and for about 5 years afterwards. We've lost that capacity to be able to navigate the UN system. And so I think it would take a long time for us to get back to where we were in capability and become, once again, one of the premier peacekeepers of the world.
That throws us into the future and aspirations for what can actually be done. I don't want to leave Gaza and Israel just yet, and I do want to bring in Haiti on a similar point. We can bury our heads in the sand about certain conflicts, and we can feel compassion or fury about others, but there are practical concerns as well. Many commentators have mentioned the fact that such conflicts, whether in Gaza, Israel, and Haiti, they can produce a new generation of people who can be radicalized, people who don't have a future where they live. You can see the waves of migration from Haiti right now, which are showing up on the American border. And in fact, the Canadian border has proven in the last few years to be not that far from the U.S. southern border. So the nature of these conflicts and the migration, it's just a different place than it was even 30 years ago when we were at our height. We're going to have to face these things one way or the other. The question is, which way? And I guess we move to the crystal ball portion of the conversation.
These conflicts are open wounds in the world body. Not only is there a moral obligation to try and contribute to them and to alleviate human suffering, but there's also a very important national interest to prevent the expansion of those conflicts, that there be radicalized people who are willing to take out their anger on others around the globe, and including our European allies, our American ally, and indeed in Canada itself. And there's also the danger that these conflicts will spread disease. They'll increase human trafficking and the spread of guns and of violence more generally. There's all the dire people who are desperately seeking a refuge and finding a place where they could live in peace. And that's a major concern for Europe and also in the United States, as you mentioned, from Haiti, and to some extent Canada as well. So it's really in the national interest to be able to contribute to solutions to these conflicts, and peacekeeping is definitely part of that. So in the future, I see that the hopeful future is one in which Canada re-engages in peacekeeping, that it provides leadership, it has a lot of the characteristics that are needed. It's always had the capacity to work without the colonial baggage. It has a positive reputation internationally. Our forces are extremely well trained in general, and they are extremely committed. I'm proud to be working with them every day. And so this is an area where Canada could once again show its leadership and show that it can contribute to the resolution of those conflicts, not to creating more conflicts. And there's a big danger that if too much force is used in areas of the world, not necessarily by Canada, but by others like the United States in Iraq and Afghanistan, that there will be such a backlash against that these missions could fail. So I think the provision of peacekeeping forces is one in which we should see expanded. And there are times when armed force, when enforcement action needs to be taken to uphold the UN Charter, but along with that should come a mechanism of peacekeeping. So I would be happy to contribute to this theme that we're talking about, of peacekeeping, into the future so that we can see Canada once again be a prolific peacekeeper.
Well, I think on that note, we're going to call it a day. Thank you very much, Walter Dorn, for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you, Bruce. It's a pleasure to be with you.
That's your Canada Land. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything that you send. Our website is canadaland.com. Today's episode was presented by our senior producer, Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Tristan Capicchione. Our production coordinator is Andre Prue. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So-Called Syndications, handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.